This is New England Public Radio's Jazz Beat. I'm Tom Reaney with a podcast edition of my jazz blog, which you can find at nepr.net. Today's podcast focuses on Bob Dylan, Mike Bloomfield, and the Paul Butterfield Blues Band at the Newport Folk Festival on the weekend of July 23rd through 25th, 1965. Paul Butterfield plugs in, and Bob Dylan follows suit. July 25th marked the 50th anniversary of Bob Dylan going electric at the Newport Folk Festival. The milestone is being widely commemorated, and it follows the sale 2 years ago of the Fender Stratocaster he played on that Sunday night. Elijah Wald's new book, Dylan Goes Electric, Newport, Seeger, Dylan, and the Night That Split the 60s, tells the story more accurately and contextually than any previous renderings. Published by Day Street, it's a great read that's getting plenty of attention, including a glowing review in the New York Times, where Janet Maslin expressed surprise that there's more to the myth of Dylan's sonic assault on Newport than what's been contemplated ad nauseum for a half century. My interest in that epical weekend has long been focused on the leading role the Paul Butterfield Blues Band played in bringing electricity and Chicago blues to Newport, not to mention the first racially integrated ensemble in the festival's 6-year history. To be sure, two other festival performers also plugged in, the great blues band Lightnin' Hopkins and the Chambers Brothers, which, like most gospel-style groups of the era, used electric guitars but no drums. Butterfield led a pedal-to-the-metal amplified outfit, and that was part of its legend. The band's debut LP, released in October 1965, underscored this feature in a back-cover banner unique in music history. We suggest you play this record at the highest possible volume in order to fully appreciate the sound of the Paul Butterfield Blues Band. I wrote a feature on the festival when news of Dylan's guitar sold at Christie's on December 6, 2013 for $965,000. I called it Dylan's Guitar, credit Mike Bloomfield and Paul Butterfield. Elijah Wald's emphasis is different and more comprehensive than mine, but as a blues scholar and performer, he addresses the phenomenon of white boys playing the blues head-on, and he provides a detailed account of Butterfield's opening set that began with Alan Lomax's infamous introduction of the band. Lomax was unique among folklorists in having embraced rock and roll as a valid folk form, and he hailed the Chambers Brothers as exemplars of our modern American folk music, rock and roll. But he was less impressed by the prospect of a 22-year-old white blues harpist fronting the first Chicago blues band ever to appear at Newport. While on a Library of Congress field recording sojourn in 1941, Lomax had discovered Muddy Waters in Clarksdale, Mississippi. That occurred a year or more before Butterfield and guitarist Michael Bloomfield were even born, and that only added to his doubts about their ability to deliver the real thing. Muddy Waters had been at Newport twice before. He played the Jazz Festival in 1960, and for his 1964 performance at the Folk Festival, he played solo acoustic guitar in tribute to Son House. Unbeknownst to Lomax, he had also encouraged Butterfield from the outset of his unlikely encounter with a white teenager who began hanging out at the Southside Blues Clubs where Muddy held forth in the late 50s.
I don't care how long you're gone. I don't care how long you stay, but good kind treatment go bring you home someday. But someday, baby, you ain't gonna trouble for me anymore.
Lomax's intro was snide and presumptuous. He complained to the audience about having to wait for the band to set up, and Wald's account has him saying that Butterfield had come highly recommended, already the king of Chicago, which is a big tribute. I'm anxious to find out whether it's true or not. Albert Grossman, who was Dylan's manager, was a Chicagoan who'd persuaded the festival to book Butterfield, and he didn't take kindly to Lomax's condescension. When the two confronted each other offstage, blows were exchanged, and the culture war that split the weekend apart had begun. It's my contention that all the buzz about Butterfield's performance and the fight between Grossman and Lomax combined to make Dylan rethink his Newport plans. Elijah Wall doesn't go quite that far, but he allows that many insiders suggest the fight left Dylan itching to stick it to the folk establishment. He adds that Dylan was inspired by the presence of the Butterfield Band, which he'd already seen in person at the Village Gate a month earlier. He told a reporter for Time magazine that weekend, "For me right now, there are three groups, Butterfield, the Byrds, and the Sir Douglas Quintets." Dylan had already gone electric in January of 65 when he jumped down the manhole of Subterranean Homesick Blues and scored his first chart success. Like a Rolling Stone, recorded a month before Newport with Bloomfield playing the song's signature leads and turnarounds, was all over the radio by the festival weekend. On Saturday at Newport, Dylan asked Bloomfield to hastily assemble an ad hoc outfit that would back him on his main stage set on Sunday night. The group, which rehearsed that night at a Newport mansion leased by George Ween, coalesced around Butterfield's rhythm section, bassist Jerome Arnold and drummer Sam Lay, players who'd honed their chops with Little Walter and Howlin' Wolf. Barry Goldberg, a sidekick from Chicago, played the B3 organ on Like a Rolling Stone at Newport, while Al Cooper, who was the organist on the record, played bass in place of Arnold, who fumbled the changes. Cooper had come to Newport on his own as a paying customer, but shortly after his arrival, he was handed backstage passes and was deputized for the band. 6 weeks earlier, he'd arrived at the Highway 61 Revisited session assuming he'd play guitar, but as he's humbly related ever since, "Just hearing Bloomfield warm up ended my career as a guitarist. Until then, I'd never heard a white man play guitar like that." Of course, only Bob Dylan can say definitively how much his decision to go electric was inspired by the events swirling around Butterfield that weekend. What is certain is that Newport 65 certified two significant developments in popular culture: Dylan-esque folk rock and Butterfield as the new archetype of the white blues man. The latter is a complex phenomenon lying deep in the American grain, ranging from 19th-century blackface minstrelsy to Al Jolson as the jazz singer, to Paul Whiteman as the king of jazz, to Benny Goodman as the king of swing, to Elvis Presley as the king himself. As a troubadour who's continually channeled blues mythology and its floating verses, Dylan may be the ultimate exemplar of the phenomenon. He acknowledged as much with his 2001 album Love and Theft, which borrowed its name from Eric Lott's 1993 study Love and Theft, Blackface Minstrelsy and the American Working Class. Dylan's genius for disguising his sources reminds one of T.S. Eliot's adage, "Talent imitates, genius steals." Butterfield was more an imitator than a thief, and at Newport he put his stamp on classics by Elmore James and three by Little Walter. He also sang the newly minted signature tune of his rough-and-tumble hometown, born in Chicago.
1941. I was born in Chicago in 1941.
His musicianship earned him the respect of the masters, especially Muddy Waters and B.B. King, and he continually acknowledged them and helped raise the quality of the venues they played and the money they earned. As Sam Lay has said, Butterfield opened doors for us, and I know because I followed him through those doors. Billy Boy Arnold said much the same when he spoke at the induction of the Paul Butterfield Blues Band at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame this spring. Arnold noted that it wasn't until Butterfield brought his integrated band into Chicago's North Side clubs that black bluesmen began headlining there, too. Ironically, Dylan instructed Bloomfield not to play any of that B.B. King shit when he recruited him for the Highway 61 sessions. But Dylan's music would be a vastly different thing without that shit. The succession of guitarists he's employed for at least 25 years underscores the point. Jimmy Vaughan, Denny Freeman, Doyle Bramhall, Charlie Sexton, and Duke Robillard are all disciples of the late King of the Blues. Bloomfield was the first of them, and it was his Telecaster and Butterfield's Little Walter-inspired blues harp that raised such a clatter that weekend 50 years ago at Newport, Rhode Island. For concert clips, photos, and additional links, visit the jazz blog at nepr.net. I'm Tom Reno.
Down easy, baby. Mellow down easy.